Anyway, Joe Carotta is quite an individual. He has many credits to his name. He's an actor, maybe a comedian, scientist. He was named Ohio Teacher of the Year in biology. Today, he teaches at the Academy for Lifelong Learning in Sarasota. His specialty is teaching science to non-scientists. And he earned his degree at Ohio State and Cleveland State. He's a Princeton University Woodrow Wilson Fellow in bioethics. He traveled and studied in Kenya, Peru, Costa Rica, the Galapagos. He's the recipient of numerous awards. And with that, I'll turn it over to him. Joe?
Thank you very much. I'm just always amazed. I love this town so much. And I always start out this way by saying, it's just terrific that, you know, Thursday or Friday morning in January, we get a turnout like this, people just interested in hearing about a topic that's near to my heart. It's just such a pleasure. And it actually has to be a pleasure because they don't pay me very much. So I better be doing this for myself, really. I want to show you a title of an essay. It's the title of an essay by Theodore Dobzhansky, 1973. And it's a very strong statement. And I love this statement because nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And he further appended that by saying, without evolution, biology is just stamp collecting. Okay? It is the central theme. Now, contrast that with this. This is a textbook. I got it for a buck on eBay or someplace. And the reason why I searched for this book is that it's the same textbook that I used when I took biology in high school, early 60s. And it's the most widely used textbook in the United States, has been, from 1924 up until the early 60s. And I said to myself, well, let's see. I know I didn't study evolution when I was in school. I had the football coach, and he basically didn't even know what it was, I don't think. I remember in May, he said something like, well, it's May and we haven't looked at plants yet. Plants are kind of boring. Why don't you do that on your own? I wish I was making that up. I'm not. Anyway, I wanted to see what this textbook had to say about evolution. So I went to the index and the table of contents and the everything else. The word evolution is not in this book. It's the most widely used textbook in the United States. By the early 60s, the word evolution was not in here anymore. I'll explain how that worked later on. So contrast that with the fact that it's a central unifying theme. There is a chapter called The Changing View of Life. I think it's chapter 53. Are there any teachers in here? We know that you never get to chapter 53, right? So even if you have the good intentions, you just don't get that far. So what I'd like to look at this morning is the strange confluence of church and state influences that got us to this point in 1960, and where we stand now and where we may be heading. One of my jobs is since this wasn't in the textbooks, and since it wasn't always the most important topic when we took biology, that means we have a big gap in our education. It's a central unifying theme. It was basically lacking in our education. So what I do is try and fill in that gap. I'm teaching a course right now at Lifelong Learning. It's an 8-week course in evolution, and it's 8 weeks sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot. I could teach 8 more. And it's not just dry, boring stuff. I think it's pretty interesting. But what it does, though, it gives my students some factual basis so that what they get isn't what they read in magazines or see on TV. And I'm going to deal with some of those things, too. Since there are these gaps in education, we've ended up with several pretty glaring misconceptions. These misconceptions are due to several things. They've arisen from Number one, misuse of terminology. I'll get to that fairly quickly. Some of the terms that people use in the vernacular are different from terms that are used in science. Some are misapplications by popular media. And then some others are intentional attempts by special interest groups that interfere with the process of scientific education. Historically, these misconceptions, they've provided misguided rationales justifying prejudice, eugenics, social inequity, and genocide. I wish I could tell you how many times I've been asked this question. Do you believe in evolution? Hey, there's Joe, you believe in evolution? Come on over here, settle this for us. And my answer to that is always the same. I say, would you please restate the question? Because it's not a matter of faith. I don't believe in gravity. And I don't believe that the earth is round. All right? This terminology sometimes is pretty important, so I ask people to restate it just so they know where I'm coming from. You know, and the other question that I'm asked always is, why are you teaching such a controversial subject? I made the mistake about my dental assistant. I told her I was teaching this class of lifelong learning. She said, what's the class? I said, it's evolution. She kind of, Very simply, in science, there is no debate over the acceptance of evolution. I'll say that again. There is no debate. We'll talk about what the media has done, but there is no debate. It's accepted by everyone, all right? How it works, you can talk about. But the fact that things change is not a matter for debate. That's why I don't debate it. I don't debate that any more than a geologist would debate with the Flat Earth Society. I saw a sign several years ago. My wife and I were driving through this town, and there was a sign in front of a church, and it said, tonight, and the topic for discussion was God versus Darwin. You know, why do people set these things up? She said, you should go in there and talk. And I said, no, I think the smart money would be on God in that particular locale. What I'd like to do is talk about what evolution is. First, start out by talking about what evolution is and what it isn't. Okay, what it is, I'll just give you the definition for it. That's the definition for evolution. There's a couple key words in there, and I'm sorry if I'm blocking you. Genetic changes in a population over the course of many generations. Genetic changes. So there's something genetic has to happen for evolution to occur. We use some terms vernacularly, and they're not. For instance, we say, "Well, I moved to Florida and I adapted to living in Florida." Well, that's not evolution. Okay, you put on a coat when it's cold. That's not evolution. All right, something genetic has to happen because then it's passed on from generation to generation. That's evolution. Right. So I'll get into the specifics. Many generations. That's another very important one. Right? There's long periods of time involved. It's not something that just happens very quickly. Now, what isn't it? And this is pretty important too, because I've had people say to me, for example, "All right, you believe in evolution. What about this Big Bang theory? This earth, there was nothing there in the universe, and all of a sudden it exploded, and then you had stuff, and you, what are you trying to?" And my answer to the Big Bang theory is, I don't know. I have no idea what happened in the Big Bang theory. I've read it, but I don't really understand it all that well. Fact is, the origin of the universe has nothing to do with evolution at all. All right? Here's what it doesn't, what evolution is not concerned with. Several things that it's not concerned with. It's not concerned with the origin of the universe. It's not concerned with the origin of the earth. It's not concerned with the origin of life on earth. Now, people are exploring that, of course. Nothing wrong with that. But that's not what evolution is. So, at some point there was no life on earth, and then at some point there was life on earth. Where did that first life come from? Well, there's some theories, there's some hypotheses as to where that first life came from. But that's not part of the theory of evolution. Evolution picks up with that first life and what happened from then on. So, you know, people if they challenge you on that, if you say that you think evolution is pretty good, and they say, "Yeah, what about that first light?" We say, "No, this doesn't have to do with that at all." All right, so put that aside. It's not just concerned with changes that occur during a lifetime. It's not just concerned with the origin of humans. I mean, this is a tough one. This is a tough one for a lot of people. You know, the apes and the monkeys thing. And, you know, I taught high school for 30 years. And, you know, if you're taught a certain thing, you're taught, we're not apes, we're not monkeys. Well, you know, what I tell people, what I've told students is, look, if you have a hard time with that part of it, all right, let's just put that part over here for a minute. Let me tell you how evolution works, and let me tell you about natural selection and Darwin's discoveries and things like that. What happened? Okay. Nothing's falling, right? Okay. Uh-oh. I'm in a church, and I'm talking about evolution. It's over. I'm sorry. My wife warned me this would happen. Wow, just when I was talking about apes and man, too, that's amazing. That's terrific. What I tell them is put that part aside. Let me tell you about how natural selection works. And if you think that you're not part of the natural world and that these theories don't apply to you, fine. But once you accept the fact that you're an animal, and of course the football, hey, I'm no animal. I say, what are you, a plant? You know, yes, we're animals. Why wouldn't the laws of nature work on us the same way they work on everything else? Stop being so arrogant. Get over yourself a little bit. So it's not just concerned with the origin of humans. It's concerned with how everything has come about. And then not the same thing as natural selection, which I'm going to deal with right now, as a matter of fact. We've heard that Darwin's theory is called the theory of natural selection. Well, let me just really briefly, this normally takes a week to explain. I'll explain it in about 2 minutes because I'm so good. These are some of the points of natural selection. First, in the very simple observations, really. First, he observed, he studied Thomas Malthus, said this, came up with this originally, that populations grow geometrically. What does that mean? It means populations, if left on their own, their tendency is to reproduce, like this. The little green line there is what a population does if it's unfettered. So if you start out with with bacteria, if you start with one bacterium, it splits in half, becomes two, becomes four, becomes eight, and that's exactly what that number is. It's an exponential curve. In nature, that doesn't happen. In nature, you don't have population explosions. They're extremely rare. Why? Well, because something in nature is keeping them from, given if they could, they would keep reproducing that much and overpopulating. But there's things in nature that stop them from doing that. What are those things? Well, things like predators, things like temperature, things like water availability. So there's things that are called limits on population growth. And they prevent the organisms from surviving to reproduction age. And those limits, by the way, are not the same all the time. That's why you have to be careful when somebody says only the strong survive. Strength doesn't always have something to do with it. It could be the smartest ones. It could be the ones with the best coloration. It could be the ones with the best biochemistry. Those things, depending on what your environment is, are the things that will be that nature will be using to choose who gets to survive and who doesn't survive, right? Now, a simple observation. There is variation within a species. Well, what's that mean? Well, it just means look around. You know, there's variation here. There's heights, there's skin colors, there's all sorts of biochemical variations. Every population has variations. If it didn't, the only populations that don't have variations are populations that are clones of each other. But in nature, there is variation. I'm not making any judgment on the variation. I'm just saying there is variation, right? And what Darwin did, and this is the key to his whole thing. It's very simple, very, very simple, elegant. He said, if you have a very favorable variation, you're going to survive. That's all. If you don't, you won't survive. So who survives? The ones with the favorable variations for that particular environment. If the environment changes, nature might start picking different organisms to survive. That's all natural selection is. If you can understand this, you can explain natural selection to somebody. I'll go one further here. And the next step is that if you have a population that gets geographically separated, enough changes may accumulate to form a new species. Let me just give you a diagram of that. Okay, that's an awful picture. But what that represents up on top there, that represents that brown glob up there, represents a population of organisms that are pretty much the same. They're all the same as each other, right? And this represents a barrier, like a river or a mountain range that grew and separated these guys from these guys. Right? And during the course of time, you notice that they start to change a little bit. Nature's selecting differently over here than they are over here. And by the time you get over here, they look very different than they did originally. And the key is right here, that if you take one of these and one of these and you put them together, they cannot mate and produce fertile offspring anymore. That's the definition of what a new species is. Let me give you an actual example. True story. 5 million years ago, in northern Arizona, what's now northern Arizona, there's an area called the Kaibab Plateau. And on that plateau, there lived a large population of squirrels. And there was variation within them. Some were different colors. They had different eating habits, different predators on them. Okay. But what happened significantly, let's just say this is it right here. Up the middle of that plateau, a little creek started to wear through the rock. It was called the Colorado Creek. This was 5 million years ago. It started wearing through the sandstone at the rate of about, a foot every 1,000 years, and eventually became the Colorado River, and that it was at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. So, the Grand Canyon, if you've been up there, that's a big barrier. So the squirrels on this side and the squirrels on this side are left there. The ones over here, nature is operating on them differently. Why? Well, if you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, the north rim is very different from the south rim. The north rim, the climate's different. I mean, it snows up there until almost July. The predators are different. The coloration, protective coloration is different. The foods that are available are different. So nature is working on these, selecting, picking, and choosing who gets to live here. Meanwhile, it's doing the same thing back here. Now, they were all part of the original species, but they've been separated. These guys over here are being worked on differently. Today, on the south rim, that's the Abare squirrel, and that's the squirrel that lives on the south rim. The squirrel that lives on the north rim is the Kaibab squirrel. And if you took today, 5 million years later, if you took an Abare squirrel and a Kaibab squirrel and you put them in a nice little cozy den and you played some Barry White and got them a nice bottle of Cabernet, they can't do it. Now, they might be able to do it, but they can't produce fertile offspring anymore. They are different species. So what did you have to have? You had to have separation. You had to have nature working on the two sides differently. And then, when you put them back together again, something happens. There's a number of things that could happen. Sometimes they just don't fit anymore. Sometimes the egg and the sperm are incompatible chemically. But sometimes they do join, but the embryos don't survive. But that means they are no longer the same species. That's speciation. Very simple example of it. That's how you get a new species. What's Darwin's title of Darwin's book? Origin of Species. How do new species originate? That's it. Okay. Just a few other little points about Darwin's work. He did not use the terms higher and lower. That's very important because you know that if you've seen those idiotic drawings that Nazi Germany had. They had all the classes of human beings ranked from higher to lower, which is insane. He did not even use the word evolution in his original work. The reason why is that the word evolution at his time had something to do with progress. And progress implies, again, that you're making yourself higher than other organisms. A more accurate description of the way things evolve is a branching bush. So, you know, one of the postulates of evolution is that life had a single origin, that there was one time that life started on this planet. Now, real briefly, the reason why we can say that is because there are so many similarities between the simplest bacterium and us. We've all got DNA. I mean, if life started several different places, why wouldn't they have a different reproductive molecule? Why would they have the exact same thing? Which has been, so the theory is they've been passed on since the very first life. So the branching bush started down here, went out to sprout. So where are we? Well, we go up this one over here, the vertebrates go over here, the mammals go over here, the primates go over here, and we're one of the branches, you know, our biological classification, we're classified as a type of a primate, and you know, one of the little branches. Not the top of the ladder. That's our problem, is that when you start thinking of yourself the top of the ladder, that means you're above nature, that means you can exploit it and abuse it any old way you want to. We're one of those little branches. And we could be pruned just as easily as all the other ones have been pruned in history. We're doing a pretty good job of it, I think. So, what about the common misconceptions? Let me go through a few of them. This is my favorite. And this one you will see. Okay, first common misconception. Evolution is only a theory. There's lots of theories. Why don't we teach our students all of these theories and let them make up their own mind? That sounds fair. I have a great little cartoon here. And it's this little girl and her pet horse, and they're on the edge of a ravine here. And the little girl says, okay, now the quickest way to go home is to float across this ravine, and I believe we can do that. And the horse says, so you just dismiss gravity? And she says, yep, I say it's an unproven theory that's been shoved down our throats in science class. And the horse says, well, so how are you going to disprove it? She says, that's where you come in. The problem with that is that the word theory right there, okay? The word theory in common vernacular is very, very misleading. It means, I mean, when you say, you know, I have a theory about who's going to win between the Niners and the Saints, that's really a hypothesis. That's not a theory. I have a theory why she left him. No, that's a theory. That's a hypothesis. A theory. When you're making an hypothesis, nobody really knows the reasons, but we can guess. It's what they used to call an educated guess. Not a theory, a hypothesis. A theory is a well-documented explanation of some aspect of the natural world. So there's the definition of theory. I started doing this several years ago. I started capitalizing theory when I use it in science. It's very, very different from the way we use theory in our day-to-day life. And I usually, I'm watching TV and somebody goes, I have a theory. No, that's a hypothesis. Like, let's stop them. In science, a theory is so powerful that it incorporates facts, laws, and hypotheses. Theories explain hundreds and thousands of facts. In science, a theory is more important than a fact because it incorporates facts. It ties them all together. So when scientists speak of theories, they're talking about scientific concepts that have been so thoroughly tested, they're very, very unlikely to change. Matter of fact, if you were to come up with something that proved that a theory was wrong, a scientific theory was wrong, step right up to Sweden, instant Nobel Prize. Guarantee it. So these people, I've managed to disprove evolution. No, you didn't. We'll talk about some people that have tried that. Anyway, the end result of centuries of scientific effort. They draw on a lot of interconnected observations and ideas. They are the end products of science. Here's some scientific theories. This might surprise you because we tend to think of them as facts. But these are theories Again, the word fact, the word theory, very close. The difference is that a theory is actually bigger than a fact. So these are some theory, atomic theory. That doesn't have anything to do with atomic bombs. This has to do with the fact that everything we know is made up of atoms. Simple. It sounds like a fact, right? No, it's a theory. Cell theory, every living thing, it has cells inside of it. Chromosome theory, which is how we know now how DNA is carried in chromosomes and passed on from generation to generation. Electricity. Sounds like a fact, right? No, it's a theory. What does it say? Well, it says that electrons are moving at certain speeds, and sometimes they create currents. Evolution, right in there. The germ theory. You know, this. You look historically. You look back at the plague years when people caught the plague. They came up with hypotheses as to what was causing the plague, and you know, they started burning people and slaughtering animals and ringing the church bells and throwing ashes on themselves. No, they didn't know what really caused the plague. They were making hypotheses. Today we know germs are caused by viruses and bacteria and fungi. They're caused by microorganisms. We're pretty sure their method of transmission, too. Saved a lot of lives. Heliocentric, that's a fancy way of saying that the Earth goes around the sun and not vice versa. Remember that, you know, for a couple thousand years, everybody believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. Plate tectonics. You know, 40 years ago, this wasn't even in the books. You know, it was kind of a hunch. Well, we know now that the Earth's surface, that we float on plates, that they move, they crash into each other, they cause earthquakes, tidal waves, volcanoes. The theory of relativity, again. So these are strong things in science. These are theories. And evolution is as well documented as any one of these things. So in 2005, when George W. Bush stated, this is a quote, "The jury is still out on evolution." You know that what he demonstrated was that he had a very poor understanding of the word theory. Unfortunately, when a statement like that comes from the president, it provides ammunition for every conservative school board in the country. That's exactly what happens. Common misconception number two. Evolution has never been observed. Hey, evolution, I never saw it. Well, I'll tell you something. It has been observed over and over and over again in the lab and in the outside world. One of the simplest observations is insects and DDT. When they first started spraying DDT on bugs, it wiped them all out, except for a couple of them. And those couple of them survived, and they reproduced. And guess what they made? A strain of insects that were resistant to DDT. So now they have to use a double dose of DDT. And it wipes them all out, except for a couple that are resistant. And they make, that's why, you know, you spray DDT on the roaches today, and they go, yeah, come on, give me more of that stuff. You know, you joking me? The same thing is true with bacteria and antibiotics. When they first started using penicillin on bacteria, it wiped them all out entirely, completely, except all you need is one with bacteria because they reproduce asexually. So if one survives, it can go ahead and make a whole new colony of resistant bacteria. Today, the concentration of penicillin that we have to use is more than 7 times the concentration of when we first started using it. And that's, you know, 70 years ago, maybe. Yeah. I'll show you another little illustration of observed evolution. These are two moths. These are peppered moths. Dark. It comes in two varieties, dark and light. Right? Doesn't, you know, they're exactly the same except their colors are different. That's their big difference. Well, these moths, by the way, live in. They've been studied in England, and during the day, they sleep on trees, and the forests were largely birch forests, so during the daytime, these guys blended in very well, and these guys did not. It sort of looked like this. And you can barely see the light-colored moth, and you get the dark ones. So when the birds come along, who love eating moths, they eat the dark ones. Did they wipe them out? No. Did they cause them to become extinct? No. But if you looked at the population numbers, you'd find that probably 90% of the moths were light-colored and 10% were dark-colored. That's natural. Well, no, not natural selection yet. What happened then was that the environment changed. Why did it change? Because the factories started belching out smoke and changing the birch trees from light to dark. And now, it looks like this. But guess what? You're out of luck, pal. So, if you did a population study, 90% of these survived. So it just changes the numbers. Now, this isn't making a new species, but it's natural selection. Let me rephrase that. It's sort of artificial selection because man's involved in it, but it's still a type of selection. So that's an observation. Somebody says there's no such thing. Yeah, it's very easy to explain or to give an example of natural selection. More importantly, we always think, since we're human beings, we use our eyes are so important to our taking in information, we tend to say, well, seeing is believing. Well, there's other ways to observe and to get information about the world. And scientifically, the number of observations supporting evolution is absolutely overwhelming. Some of those observations are based on the fossil record, which is really good compared to what it was 150 years ago. Comparative anatomy. You take my class and I'll explain that one to you. But the fact is, if you look at the front flippers of a whale, and they have the same exact bones we do. They have the humerus, they have the two forearm bones, they have carpals, metacarpals, exact different lengths, but they're the same bones, which indicates that why wouldn't you, if whales came out of nowhere, why didn't they just have one big bone there? Wouldn't that make more sense? Biochemistry, to me, is the most supportive evidence. Again, we all have the same reproductive molecules. Beyond that, when we eat food, and food goes into our cells, and the food has to be broken down biochemically, you find the same biochemical pathways in mammals as you do in frogs, as you do in plants, as you do in bacteria, as you do in fungi, as you do in worms. The same biochemical pathways. Are they 100% efficient? No. But they're the ones that got passed on. They're good enough. They got passed on and passed on. The point about the 100% efficient is, why isn't there another pathway? If life popped up several different times during our history, you'd have several different more efficient pathways. You'd have different pathways. We don't. We don't. They're all the same. Misconception number three. And this one's, I used to hear this one a lot, that there's no transitional fossils. A transitional fossil means, I'll give you an example. Birds came from reptiles, okay? So where's the bird tile? That's a transitional. So between one species or one type of organism and another. And that used to be a very big misconception. When the fossil record wasn't as good as it is today. Today, the fossil record is much, much better than it used to be. And of course, if you ever heard of something called the Archaeopteryx, it is a bird reptile. It's halfway between a reptile and a bird. It's got scales, it's got teeth, it has feathers, it has claws, it's halfway between the two. So there's lots of transitional fossils. But more importantly, it's a weak argument about transitional fossils, because the fossil record is very, very incomplete. Most things die and they get decomposed. And so the odds of finding a transitional fossil is very slim. Having said that, we found quite a few of them, enough to support that there are such things as transitional fossils and transitional species. Next one. Misconception. Evolution says again, this is somebody who doesn't understand evolution. They think it means that life originated and that evolution proceeds by random chance. It's too random. How could you get human being? How could you get the human eyeball? How could that be formed randomly? I'm sure you've heard that or seen it. Well, the variation part of evolution is random, or as random as you can get in nature. In other words, why are there different sizes appendages and skin coverings on organisms? Well, that's by variation. But the selection part is very specific. In other words, who gets to survive and who doesn't survive is very specific. You might have heard this argument. I've heard people say that saying that man could be formed through random chance is the same as putting a bunch of monkeys in a room and having them type out Hamlet. Heard that one? Well, actually, they did a computer simulation on that. And they're right. If it's totally random, the monkeys will never type out Hamlet. But they use a computer model where you started selecting. In other words, here's the monkeys hit the keys randomly, but if you selected that T and saved it, like nature does, if you selected that O and you saved it, like nature does, and then you selected the B, and you could get the phrase to be or not to be in 90 seconds. Further, the whole play Hamlet, you could do in about 4.5 days. If you're selecting. So it's not random. It's random variation, but the selection process is the important part. So yeah, you can get some pretty complicated organelles. Our human eye is pretty complicated. Did it just pop up out of nowhere? No, there's all sorts of pre-models to the human eye. That's a book in itself. This one I'm hearing more recently, the last misconception, is that scientists are not interested in examining or teaching both sides of the evolution debate. Now, that's in quote. It's in quotes, okay? Because, again, in science, there is no debate over the acceptance of evolution. And what's happened is that the media is trying to promote a fairness doctrine. And they give equal time to both pro- and anti-evolution viewpoints. But in actuality, the weight of evidence on both sides is nowhere near being close to equal. There are not two equally valid sides to every argument. If you want fair play, what you do is you publish. And then you get peer-reviewed. And ideas that are not supported by evidence are tossed out. If you want to get an idea into a textbook, this is what you have to do. So science, when you have a new idea and you want to get into a textbook, first you come up with this novel scientific claim, you form a hypothesis, remember that's just your guess, and then you research that hypothesis with repeatable results. This takes a long, long time, years and years and years. Then once you've got it, you say, I think I've got it now, then you submit it to peers, people who know what they're talking about. And you had this includes writing, meetings, debates, you accept criticism, you go back and change it a little bit, counter experiments, and you try to establish that your idea has evidence behind it. Finally, if you're really, really, really lucky, you come up with a scientific consensus, then you can publish it, and then finally it gets into classrooms and textbooks. The folks who are involved with intelligent debate or intelligent design, this is their version of this. Ready? Hypothesis, textbooks. This has happened. Simple. Hypothesis, textbooks. Nothing, no experimentation. Matter of fact, there is no experimentation because you can't experiment on it. They try to short-circuit the process. And again, President Bush weighed in with the following comment. He said, I feel that both sides ought to be properly taught so that people can understand what the debate is about. You know, if they really wanted fair play, by the way, if they wanted fair play, they would demand the inclusion of the over 80 creation myths that exist in the world today rather than just one that they're pushing. You know, in science, we don't have a debate, or we don't have a poll in USA Today to figure out how many chromosomes we've got. If a vocal segment of the population decides that 46 is an unpleasant number. Right? I had an administrator who really wasn't, they're never science guys, but he was not a science guy. And he said, well, what are you doing about this evolution thing? Are you going to do both, both sides of the argument? And I said, well, yes, I will. I'll be happy to do that. By the way, when I'm teaching germ theory about how diseases come, is it okay if I give equal weight to demonic possession? Because... Not sure you got it, but I don't care. So those are some misconceptions. Now I want to deal with some misinterpretations. Two of the most grotesque misinterpretations through history are social Darwinism and eugenics. Social Darwinism is very strange. It's a it's just a catch-all phrase. And what it does, it describes utilitarian philosophies. You're studying philosophy. A utilitarian philosophy is basically one you come up with that justifies what you're doing. And this philosophy attributed human progress to unfettered competition among individuals. So who would support that? Somebody who really likes unfettered competition. Also somebody who's also got a lot of power already and wants to continue to have it. It basically was used by people at the top to continue to justify their own practices. In history, it's been used to justify imperialism and racism. You would say something like, it's for the betterment of the colonized people that we do this. We're really helping them out. And it was strongly supported by, well, people like Malthus, Carnegie, Rockefeller. Of course, they would jump all over that. And you notice that its ideas actually, the ideas behind it predated Darwinian biology. Darwin had nothing to do with this term didn't buy this at all, okay? We're getting on some dangerous ground here. The dangerous ground is taking Darwin's theory and applying it to human beings. I'll explain why that's not a good idea. But first I want to talk about eugenics. Eugenics says this. By the way, it was coined by Darwin's cousin. Darwin, again, had nothing to do with this. It said, human beings, fit humans produce fit offspring. It's a waste to try to cultivate the unfit, just like plants. Humans should use selective breeding to eliminate the unfit. And, of course, then they started linking things like intelligence, beauty, and health with ability. Now, why did this even come about? It came about because Mendel, the father of genetics, his work was done at the same time Darwin's work, but Mendel's work was put on a shelf in the monastery for about 40 years and wasn't really rediscovered until about 1900. So Darwin's ideas, among the scientific community, they were just talking about them all the time. They gained wide acceptance. But the problem was they didn't know physically how it worked. Since they didn't know what a gene was, they didn't know how characteristics were passed on and how they could skip a generation, for example. They lacked a physical basis for backing up evolution. Well, with Mendel's work and his work with the pea plants, which extended out to just about everything, it offered a physical basis for Galton's theories. Now, eugenics, if you think about it, can go two ways. Positive eugenics means that let's make sure that the upper classes continue to breed with the upper classes. Let's make sure that good characteristics continue to mate with others that have good characteristics, quote. On the other hand, negative eugenics sought fewer children for the unfit. Now we've got to define what unfit means. Well, they did that. They were very nice. They decided that unfit meant mental illness, mental retardation, epilepsy, any kind of gross physical defects, and criminality at first. And so people said, well, we got Mendel here, we got Darwin here. They must have bad genes. We should eliminate them from the population. This is obviously it's a grotesque manipulation of what Darwin said. Another question, okay, so how do you determine who's fit and who's not fit? How do you determine whose intelligence, for example, You know, what's above and below intelligence? Just at this time, they came up with a test to measure that, the IQ test. And so if you're below 80, you certainly can't function in society. And there, of course, there were people that thought those genes should be eliminated from the population. And, of course, the bad thing about the IQ test is that it stressed genetic over environmental influences. So positive eugenics, that was supported by people like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, Winston Churchill. They even used phrases like, we have to be careful that we're not committing race suicide, meaning the upper classes. Reproduce, let's go. Negative eugenics, of course, like I said, sought fewer children for the unfit. I was amazed. About 2 years ago, the Sarasota Film Festival had a movie called The War Against the Weak. And in that movie, I found out that there was something called the Eugenic Record Office in the United States. It existed from 1910 to 1944. And its purpose was to track genealogies. This was started at Cold Spring Harbor. It was funded by Carnegie. The United States, not Nazi Germany, not Russia, the United States was the first country to embark on a systematic forced sterilization program for the purpose of eugenics. One of its goals was to eliminate the lowest 10% of the population. This is in their manuscripts. What are its targets? Orphans, I have a list here, orphans, ne'er-do-wells, tramps, the homeless and paupers, defective persons who were a menace to society, feeble-minded, most Russian and Polish immigrants, alcoholics, criminals, prostitutes, nomads, and other Americans, quote, born to be a burden on the rest. While he was in prison in the late 20s, Hitler actually read some of the work from the U.S. Eugenics Record Office and said, hey, this is pretty good stuff. All 48 states, by the way, at this time, and most Western countries had sexual segregation of mentally retarded couples during their reproductive years. Between 1900 and 1960, over 60,000 individuals were sterilized under compulsory programs in the United States. And it was upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court by no less than Oliver Wendell Holmes. Famous case, Buck versus Virginia. Carrie Buck, her mother was a prostitute. She was claimed to be sexually promiscuous because she was raped, and they wanted to sterilize her. And she got a lawyer to take it to court. Virginia said, it's okay. They went to the Supreme Court, and Oliver Wendell Holmes' quote was that three generations of imbeciles are enough. And he upheld the sterilization. Fortunately, Virginia's state sterilization law was repealed in 1974. So when the Germans after the war were looking, when they were on trial in Nuremberg, they said, hey, you guys did it. They used this Oliver Wendell Holmes case. It's, you know, you guys did it in your own country. What are you talking about? How could we be bad? 35 United U.S. states and European countries had compulsory programs of sexual sterilization of mentally ill, retarded, criminals, epileptics, and of course, Germany included Jews and gypsies. And Germany eventually moved from sterilization to euthanasia. Eventually, it took till the end of the war for the geneticists to realize that heredity is very complex and there's a lot of environmental factors involved. By the way, the work of the Eugenic Record Office was linked with Nazi Germany at that time because they realized they were doing the same thing, and that's when the office went out of existence. But for a half century, 50 years, governments used misinterpretation of science to form eugenic policies. The problem, I mentioned this earlier, the problem is that you have to be very, very careful when you're applying evolutionary standards to human beings. Because, with rare exceptions, our survival today does not depend on our genes. Unless you're talking about a natural resistance to a disease or something like that. I mean, look at us. We've doubled our lifespan. You know, 35 used to be old age, and that's not a long time ago. We're talking about 100 years ago, maybe 150 years ago. We've doubled it. So all those things that we used to have that nature used to select against, they're not selected against anymore. I mean, think of, go back a quarter of a million years. If you were nearsighted and you were a hunter, you were dead. You know, if your intelligence level is a little bit low, if your speed, if your eyesight, if any of those things were a little bit we don't have those. We look at the things we walk around with today. We have all sorts of things that would normally cause us to die. I'm not complaining. I'm glad we've got them because I'm glad to be alive. But you know, we're years past our normal lifespan. The reason why we sidestep natural selection is because we control our own environments. You know, ever since we started making our own homes and putting on furs, we were able to go into inhospitable areas and survive there. And we can do that. Another thing is that a lot of our evolution has become purely cultural these days, because we made our clothes rather than grow more hair. We made better weapons rather than becoming stronger. We learned, since we had written word and oral and a complicated vocabulary, we could pass on learned behaviors rather than having to discover them anew, is natural in the animal kingdom. So with rare exceptions, our survival does not depend on genes alone. It could happen someday. Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, there's some super bug could get out, the ozone layer could open up, and all of a sudden, you know, ultraviolet rays would become a survival factor for us, much more than it is today. And there's things that could happen, but right now, we're pretty safe from all that stuff. That's one of the reasons why our population is so high. The scary thing about all this stuff is that, especially when we're talking about things like eugenics, is that they have a lot more to do with plugging into public opinion than they have to do with scientific facts. And they, by plugging into public opinion and shouting it enough times, you can make an idea, no matter how repulsive, you can make it more legitimate. We've seen this in history over and over again. So, again, talking about our own history. Around the turn of the century, Darwin's work is going pretty strong. Mendel's work has been discovered. There was an increase in religious liberalism in Protestant denominations. And what that did was it kickstarted a strong backlash in Protestant fundamentalism. And it reached a climax, of course, with the Scopes trial. If you know anything about the Scopes trial, well, most of us know about the Scopes trial from Inherit the Wind. No. The Scopes trial wasn't really like that at all. John Scopes I don't think he ever spent a day in jail. He was actually recruited, the ACLU was trying to recruit somebody to test this law, and he said, yeah, I'll do it. I didn't even think he was a biology teacher. He was a substitute teacher. And so a lot of the facts that you see in Inherit the Wind, although it's a wonderful play, don't really fit. Some of the things that did fit was that William Jennings Bryan did get up on the stand and did try to use the Bible as factual, and you know, Clarence Darrow, of course, they had that terrific scene that was pretty much comes from the court transcript. Well, the odd thing about the trial was that during the trial, nobody ever disputed the fact that Scopes violated the law. They both said he was guilty, and it was just a show trial. And you know, we had radio then, so it was broadcast on. But nobody disputed the fact he was guilty. He was found guilty. He was fined $100. He was fined $100. His conviction was overturned, but the statute was upheld as constitutional. Everybody knows who that is, right? That's me. I played William Jennings Bryan back in 1983. I'd love to do that. Isn't that looking old? Yeah, that's me. William Jennings Bryan character. Yeah, it's funny because I had to play the opposite end. You know? So anyway, what it did to the U.S., remember, this book was first published in 1924. So what the publishers started to do was they realized that if you just used a few simple linguistic tricks, you could keep your textbook alive, you don't have to worry about adoption of your textbook. They found that if they substituted a weak synonym for the word evolution, like racial development, progressive development, or change, eventually just got weeded right out and you know, disappeared by the 60s. So they could say whatever they wanted to say. By the way, I presume you knew this, one of the reasons why a textbook like this gets adopted by 65% of the country is because big states like Texas do their textbook adoptions by state, not by district. You know, I'm from Ohio, and we do it by district. But they adopt their textbooks by state. So that's a big order for a publisher, right? So the publisher basically says, what would you like us to have in the book? And they say, well, here's a list of things, and here's something that we would like you to eliminate from the book. And that's the book that goes out to the rest of the country. So that's sort of how that starts. It's still going on today, except the difference is today there's a lot more publishers, and there's a lot more different versions of books. Now, over the next 30 years since the Scopes trial, again, evolution was downplayed. But then, in the 60s, when Sputnik happened, and we were just flabbergasted that the Russians got into put something into space before we did, we said, hey, wait a second. What are those Russians doing in their schools? And they found out their kids were doing calculus in the second grade and learning about things like evolution. So the United States' response to that was they put a lot of money to publishers. They said, come up with a textbook that has all this stuff in it. And luckily for me, I started teaching in the early 70s, and the textbook, my first textbook that I got to teach from, had evolution on page one and took it all the way through. So there were a couple of court cases, another case in 1965 that was almost as important as the Scopes trial. The backlash to the evolution inclusion was, there was another conservative backlash, and that was the creationist movement. They started coming up with textbooks that had creationism in it. Now, they usually did not name the creator, but the implication was that evolution was not correct because evolution equaled Russians, equaled atheists, equals communism. So by the 70s, we had three states, and they had what they called the balanced treatment, where they were allowed to teach both. And again, Supreme Court said in 1987, nope, that's religion, it's out. So most recently, what we've got is a loose group of Christian scholars that have proposed, this is their proposition, that species are just too complex to have evolved through natural selection. And those are the folks at Intelligent Design. The major backing from Intelligent Design comes from a specific place, and it comes from Seattle, Washington. It's a place called the Discovery Institute. And their claim is that a design and a designer is required to account for the origin of living things and new species. They came up with this really fancy word, irreducible complexity. This is so complex, you can't reduce it to something simple. They use the human eye for an example, which has gotten shut down so many times. But the eye is so complex, how could that have come about without a guiding hand? In other words, they say it's okay in science to depend on supernatural causes for natural events, because they say that some biological systems are just too complex. So anytime you come across something you can't explain, you can use a supernatural cause. My favorite cartoon, Sidney Harris cartoon. Guy's doing this very complicated mathematical equation stuff here, and in the middle it says, then a miracle occurs, instead of an equal sign. And this, his mentor says, I think you should be more explicit here in step two. I like that so much that I got the t-shirts. So what's the problem with these guys? Well, the problem is that a number of them have scientific credentials. They, are biologists, for example, but in no sense are they proceeding as scientists. They attempt to undermine evolution with scientific-sounding arguments, and the purpose is to advance a conservative religious political agenda. Their own private correspondence has revealed that this plan is called a wedge strategy. That's how they're going to work their way into science books and also into school boards. And the general public needs to be very cautious about soundbite news reporting, because special interest groups, they're pretty good at PR. They're pretty good at soundbites. And they can be very persuasive if you're not familiar with the facts. But the bottom line is, Intelligent Design has been rejected everywhere as valid science because it has produced no That's zero, no testable ideas. So that whole business about hypothesis and then research, they can't do research. How do you do research on something supernatural? You know, all you can do is say, it didn't happen this way. Here's how I say it happened. But as far as backing it up goes, no. That's why it's religion. I never thought that I would have a conservative Bush-appointed judge as my hero. Judge John Jones is my hero. In Dover, Pennsylvania, 2005, the school board there said that the science teachers had to teach intelligent design as an alternative in their classrooms. The teachers refused, they were fired, and they sued. Well, the trial lasted for a week, and Judge John Jones, again, they thought that this was going to be when intelligent design got into the classrooms. And Jones, again, very conservative, Bush appointee, listened to a week's worth of testimonies from the intelligent design backers and dismissed it entirely. He called it thinly disguised creationism. In his decision, he used these words. He said the school board acted with breathtaking inanity. I just love this guy. The leading witness, by the way, for ID, and you'll see his name all. You see him if you see this name in the paper, his name is Behe, B-E-H-E, Michael Behe. He's a biologist. I think he's a molecular biologist. But he testified under oath, because he works for Intelligent Design folks, the Discovery Institute. He said under oath that under his definition of scientific theory, astrology would be as legitimate as intelligent design in a classroom, right? There is, by the way, I had this thought yesterday. There's a film out, a tape and a DVD that was on PBS. It's called Intelligent Design on Trial. And it's about an hour and a half, 2 hours. It's a record of this trial. It's really, really, really good. Not only does it talk about the trial, but it also talks about Darwin, shows a few things that he did. And I highly recommend it. Matter of fact, if you had a small group of people that was going to get together and watch this thing, I'd be more than happy to come and throw my 2 cents in on it. So, Intelligent Design on Trial is the name of it. You could talk to me about this afterwards. In all these court cases, evolution, that involved the teaching of evolution, they have not been decided by public opinion or journalist ideas. They've been decided by what? By the constitutional definition of religion and the precedent that hinges on the prior placement of religion. So far, so good. A judge could decide that one of these proposals does not promote religion and that it would avoid conflicts with the establishment cause. That's why the judges and their appointments are so important. By the way, Florida, very explicit. I was surprised. Very, very explicit about the inclusion of evolution in their curriculum. And I looked it up. And it's very, very good. Here's the problem. The problem is the teachers aren't teaching it. A recent poll showed that 60% of biology teachers do not deal with evolution as the central unifying theme. They call it just a theory. Another 13% actually teach either creationism or intelligent design in their classroom. That's 73% of teachers that are either teaching creationism or a watered-down version of evolution. And they're probably just afraid or don't want the hassle. Yeah. The evolution's been kicked back and forth. We've had stickers on textbooks in Kansas. Kansas has a sticker that said or out. Yeah, it says this textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, and it should be approached with an open mind. And of course, they put this on all the biology textbooks. How are you supposed to teach something when you've got a disclaimer? So anyway, it was determined that was no, you can't do that. They had to take those stickers off. My main concern is that in this country that there are no qualifications for one of the most influential and important positions, elected positions, and that's a school board. You know, we tend to elect people that are bean counters for school boards. Which is fine. I think there needs to be fiscal responsibility. But if they've got an agenda like this, they can push through any old curriculum they want to. This has happened time and time again at the local level and also at the state level. I do have one little success story because, it was in the late 90s. There was we had a new school board, and Ohio was about to they wanted to change their curriculum to include intelligent design. And one of the new school board members, state school board members, was in my area. So I give her a call and I talked to her. Talked to her twice. We had two meetings. And basically, I explained this stuff to her. I explained natural selection, how it worked. She didn't know how it worked. She didn't understand. She never knew what it was. And she'd come up with these objections. No, that's not about that at all. And you know what? She changed her vote. I'm totally amazed. I'm not a political guy. My wife's the politician in the family. I'm not a and she changed her vote. Ohio stuck with keeping intelligent design out of the curriculum. And I was really happy to. So, you know, there's places that you could operate. And, wow, you know, anybody in here could run for school board and probably should, I think. So I guess just in conclusion, I thought of a way to wrap this up. And for some reason, I thought of a movie that I just saw. Remember The Thing, James Arness, the guy that discovered this vegetable man in the Arctic? What I remember from it at the very end was this, the reporter getting on the microphone and telling the rest of the world about the danger. And he said, watch the skies, watch the skies. I thought that was the scariest part of the movie. And my message is, watch the school boards. Watch the school boards. That's really a place that, you know, if you feel like you want to do something, and watch the judges also, who you're voting for. Find out what they stand for. Okay? That's it. I thank you very much.
I guess.